Throughout history, Governor, education has tended to be a privilege rather than a right, a luxury that only the select few could afford. However, the University of California has been founded in a tradition that of being tuition-free so that everyone can have an education. In this day and age, when in our society a college degree has become more of a necessity than a luxury, how can you justify a tuition fee upon the university?
Well, all right, let's just assume the premise, then, of education, unlimited virtually, being a right. I think you would agree, however, that you really couldn't add the word unlimited, because someplace along the line there must be a place where someone who would say, well, I want to spend my life getting educated, should no longer be subsidized by his fellow citizens just to satisfy his thirst for knowledge. Someplace, the reality of the education being supplied by society must coincide with the return to society of that individual's education. Now, I think the subject still could be open as to where that cutoff should be. At what point has society benefited as much as it should in the other individual? But let's ignore that and simply grant your premise that this is for the social good and it is beneficial to all of society. So then you enter into the area of it's the same as any other tax-supported program. In good tax policy, you try wherever and whenever possible to assess the charge against those who are benefiting from the charge. For example, in California, we have a gasoline tax. We build our highways with the gasoline tax. Those who drive upon the highways pay for the building of the highways. This is a perfect application of the assessing the charge against the user. So now let's take higher education. And let us say there is a social benefit, but there is also an individual benefit. The one getting the education, we can actually describe and in figures how many more thousands of dollars a year this individual will earn more than the person who doesn't have that education or doesn't even seek or try to get one. Therefore, rather than, like the gasoline tax, making the student pay the total cost of the education himself, I think we can recognize fairly, let society provide the institutions and pay a portion of the cost because of the benefit to society. But since the individual getting the education is also going to benefit over and above the rest of the benefit to the rest of the citizenry, he then pays a portion of that cost as the direct beneficiary.
But should cost then be the determining factor? Because as we know, some have money and some don't. So that you're saying that the education then is only going to be available to those that can afford the education rather than those that have the academic ability.
Well, no, because I think that a great many of the costs of education have nothing to do with the actual tuition fee. For example, a $300 tuition fee at the university when the actual cost of education prorates out to more than $3,000 for the student, finds the citizen repaying $2,700 or more for the student's education, and he is only asked to contribute less than 10% of the cost.
But if he doesn't have that 10%.
Now you go into a whole different area, and I think I know something at first hand about that, because I had to be responsible totally for my own education in college, and in a much harder time than now. It was during the Depression. And I don't say that in the usual, I made it, let everyone else make it. But let me point out what some of the helps were at that time. Part of it was work, of course. Part of it was a scholarship. Part of it also was a loan. Now, if tuition should be the difference between a student otherwise qualified getting an education and not getting an education, then the provision that I insisted be in the tuition program that was adopted for the university, the provision be that the student does not have to pay that tuition until he is out and earning, reflecting the value he received from his education, and paid over a period of years. And I would think that this could even be extended to more of the cost of going to college. Because you could give a lot of young people today their whole tuition and give it to them free, not even a loan, and they are still a million miles away from having the funds to go to college or university because they don't happen to be able to afford to live away from the family home and provide the room and board and the other costs. Now, what would be wrong with a program that would recognize those costs, tuition costs, and then set up, if you had a rotating fund in which you said to the student, all right, whatever you need to go to college, your living costs or anything else, we're prepared to underwrite if you're otherwise qualified. And at a certain point after graduation, when your earnings reach a certain level and spread over 20, 25, 30 years of your earning life, you will repay those costs for your education in a minimum amount of money each year.
Well, this brings us right to my next question, which is about EOP, the Economic Opportunity Program.
Yeah.
When tuition was initiated, it was usually with the general understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the money raised through tuition, the extra money, would go toward new programs and student aids. Yet, there hasn't been a new building started on any of the UC campuses in the last 2 years. And further, the EOP program, which permits 2,000 students who otherwise could not meet the cost of college, and just the program that you were describing, that program has not received any state support, but instead has to be financed through student donations and fundraising events. What purpose do you see then in the tuition?
Well, I don't see that tuition has anything to do with that. As a matter of fact, no decision has been made. There's been a controversy. No decision has been made by the board about the eventual permanent use of the tuition. Now, let me just say what I think is one of the reasons why no permanent decision has been made. The university itself is so reluctant to admit that this $300, which they themselves asked for, if you will remember, it was the university administration that finally proposed this tuition. They didn't call it tuition. They called it some kind of a fee. And they were reluctant to have it be applied against any of the instructional costs, because then that would define it as tuition. So it seemed as if they were trying to keep it for something that wasn't going on, in other words, for some other cost. The one decision we did make was when the bond issue failed. The capital construction, the building of buildings, supposed to be provided by bonds, again, similar to what I've suggested about students paying. It is believed that if you're going to build buildings that endure for 100 years, certainly one single generation shouldn't have to pay for them out of its taxes, so you spread the payment over the years by a bond issue. But the bond issues were defeated. Now, will you deny that perhaps one of the reasons for their defeat was some of the activities that were going on the campuses that so angered the taxpaying public that they, looking at the smoke in the sky of the buildings that were burning, decided this was not the time to build new ones. But anyway, we did recognize the need and expansion for more buildings, and so we said, pending a permanent solution of the use of tuition, we said in the first year, and we've added to that and let it continue for a time, that a large portion of that money could be used for capital construction because the people did fail to pass the bond issues. Now, I hope we can find an answer to this, the construction needs, and that between the university, the students, the government, we can impress upon the public this need and at the same time give them some assurance that they would be justified in passing future bond issues. This administration supported the $287 million bond issue that failed. In fact, I urged a great many people personally to support this and to contribute money to the campaign to get it to go over. I was quite disappointed when it failed to go over.
When you talked about capital construction, as I mentioned to you, that well, there hasn't been, since you were starting to apply the money, there still hasn't been a new building started in 2 years. And further, you didn't answer why EOP hasn't received any state support.
Oh, now we get to EOP. I don't know where this tied in with the buildings. EOP has never had any support at the university level from the state because, you know, the university does have additional funds. The actual general fund or state budget contribution is less than a third of the total cost of the university. The university's budget is actually over $1 billion. There is an amount known as the Regents' Funds from endowment and gifts that is almost as big as the total state contribution. So the university was able to fund its own EOP program and allow us to use the public funds that were available for the state colleges and for the community colleges. Now, this was an accepted fact. We were grateful for it, and it allowed us to turn the full resources that we had available and that were available from the federal government to these other two areas. And each year, EOP has been funded at a greater level in those two from the public funds. We've kept pace, and there's a misunderstanding on the part of many right today. They think that we have reduced that for the coming year in our budget request. We have reduced the state contribution because we were told that there was going to be a sizable increase from the federal government to take up that slack, and that in the end result, the total amount available for EOP would be bigger next year than it is for the present year. Now, there are voices being heard from Washington, not from the White House as yet, that are countering this and saying, no, we don't think there's going to be as much as the federal government promised. If this is true, and if they should change their minds and not give us as much as we've been expecting, we'll have to review our situation then. So we have no intention of cutting it back.
Very good. Okay, going on, you mentioned about bond issues failing and other things. So we get into the area of politics and education. And in the Carnegie Commission, in their most recent report, they stated that the governors of the 50 states have too much power over the universities. I want to know what part you felt politics play in the university.
Well, there are a lot of people today, and many of them on the campus, who like to charge this and who go running around talking about political interference. And very frankly, they either don't know what they're talking about or they're deliberately distorting the facts. Now, that's as far as California is concerned, and perhaps some other states. Because California, the Constitution makes it very plain. The system that has worked for better than 90 years in the University of California really keeps the injection of politics into the university at a minimum unequal any place in public higher education. There are some states where, you know, the governor can get on the phone and tell them who's going to be president. That isn't true here. The governor is one vote on the Board of Regents.
Right, but with the Carnegie's Commission's criticism and Clark Kerr being chairman of that commission, I hardly think that he would, although they didn't state any state in particular,
yeah.
I hardly think that they were, just California accidentally got included since they included all 50 states, that California being, first of all, the largest university system in the United States was probably a prime consideration when they made this statement and this finding.
Well, don't you suppose it's possible that Clark Kerr has a slight conflict of interest? I think that Clark Kerr's departure from the University of California, which he tried to portray as something other than his own act at one time, might have left him with a certain amount of bias. It was my first meeting as a regent when he submitted virtually an ultimatum to the regents, and the regents, and at that point I hadn't appointed any regents, so they weren't my board of regents in any way. The regents refused to accede to his ultimatum, which left him in the position of resigning. He had sent a demand for a resolution of support, and the regents refused to vote him that, which left him in the position of being a man who would deliver the ultimatum of, I will resign if not.
Am I right in saying that you claimed that you really don't feel that the governor has that much political control, so to say, over the university?
No, and let me say something else that maybe some of your people, I'm quite sure, will find difficulty believing. I'm not unaware of the image that I have on the campus in certain circles. Not only does the governor not have that control, but this particular governor wouldn't exercise it if he did. I honestly and truly do not believe in the injection of politics into the university. And one of my biggest complaints about the present University of California is not that I can't inject politics into it, but that politics has been very much injected into it at the university level. That there is literally a political saliva test given to too many people before they're affiliated with the university by the university administration and faculty. And I would like to see us back to the place where there was true academic freedom and where a professor or a student knew that he would not be subjected in a class to the personal bias of a faculty member.
Well, I want to go then from this into Angela Davis. You said right. Academic freedom. And to counteract, I don't see how you can say that a professor does not have a bias. Everyone has a bias. You have a bias, and each professor does. You can't have a completely impartial professor. So
you can in his attitude to the students. You see, this is, now I guess we come to the generation gap. There was a time, and not too many years ago, when one of the most honored ethics of the profession of teaching was that a teacher kept his personal bias out of his teaching. For example, if a student did say in, a hot political time and on some big crucial issue, said to the professor, well, what is your view? What do you feel? There was a day when a professor, in answering, he'd answer it. I don't say he'd keep the secret from students that he knew personally on the campus. He'd say, well, no, I don't mind telling you how I believe. Here's what I believe, and here's why I believe it. But it just used to be commonplace that that same professor would then say, now look, you've heard my view and why I feel that way. Now I suggest you go and ask someone else who feels the opposite and find out why they feel that way, and you do your own thinking, make up your own mind as to what you believe. Well, that ethic has disappeared to a large part from the campus, as you well know.
Is that why you and some of the other regents attacked Angela Davis, because the attack on her was basically for her political views?
No. Let's just review the history a little bit about Angela Davis. There was a rule, and I certainly couldn't be responsible for it. It was passed more than 30 years ago. There was a rule in the University of California that applied not to the theory of communism, but to, you know, communism with a small c, applied to the American Communist Party and any other organization that imposed restrictions on its members to the extent that they could not be free in their thinking. They had to subscribe to the dogma of that organization and adhere to it. Then this rule said they couldn't meet the University of California's standards for academic freedom. Now, in my book, this would apply to the Ku Klux Klan also. I don't see how a professor could stand up and be unbiased in front of a class who subscribed to a code of ethics or a dogma of an organization that he belonged to that said he had to be against immigrants, he had to be against Jews, Catholics, Negroes, the foreign
born. The professor is teaching that doctrine, as you say, since Angela Davis was teaching the philosophy of the Communist Party, and if that is what you attribute as the philosophy of the Communist Party, then a person that believes in that doctrine would be the best qualified to teach it, that'd be one of the qualifications of teaching that doctrine.
Well, not exactly. Now, let me just go back in the history here after having made this one point about the rule. Angela Davis was hired at the departmental level for a one-year term as an assistant. And a few days after her hiring, Angela Davis publicly announced she was a member of the America Communist Party. Now, this rule had never been rescinded. This rule had been overwhelmingly endorsed by the faculty back through the years.
But hadn't it been ruled made unconstitutional?
What?
Wasn't that rule proved unconstitutional at one point?
No. No. Now, she made this public statement, and it literally was in the form of a challenge. In other words, this was to say, okay, we are breaking the rule. What are you going to do about it? Now, this matter was brought to the regents. The university administration did not want to face the task of making a decision. I don't think the regents had any choice but to say, the rule is there, and this announcement, this is a direct defiance of the rule. So the regents ruled. Now they took the case to court, and they got a decision that that prevented her being discharged. At that point, the university administration, UCLA, came to the Regents and said, look, she's only been hired for 1 year, made it plain there was no intention to rehire her, and said to the Regents, you know, what's all the big fuss and so forth? Why don't we just sweat it out? And the Regents agreed, but said, now you're sure, we're talking about an assistant hired for 1 year. Now, before that 1 year was up, they came to us and announced that she was being rehired. She was never fired. They were going to hire her for a second term. She'd only been hired for one. Now, in addition to everything else, the Regents very carefully said, we are going to review this case, because the university again asked us, said they didn't want to make the decision. But the Regents said, we will review it on the basis, because of the court order, that it must have nothing to do with her membership in the Communist Party. Our decision must be on the basis of hire or rehire. Now, let me give you just some of the facets, whether some of the students agree with this or not. First of all, we found that she had quit in her progress toward her graduate degree, which was a part of the hiring agreement. She had done no further work whatsoever to advance herself for her master's degree. Second of all, during the year, she had gone to campuses both within the university system and without, community colleges, wherever there was trouble. When the riots were going on at Santa Barbara, she turned up there as a speaker. She turned up on one campus of a community college when both the students and the administration and the faculty asked her not to come because they were having trouble. And she appeared anyway and spoke from the bed of a truck just off the campus. And finally, the decision was that her conduct had actually been unbecoming that of a professor. There was another element. To have hired her would be to move her in priority at UCLA above 52 other unfilled professor spots on the campus, for which there were not funds to fill, and would have been to move her up in priority. And many of these were long unfilled and needed professor spots. Well, and the Regents decided that she should not be employed.
Well, if it was this simple of a decision with these facts to not rehire her, certainly you've not rehired other, the university has not rehired other professors without making them political martyrs, so to speak.
How did we make a political martyr of her? I happen to see.
Originally attacking her on her political views.
Well, now, what if she'd been a member of the Ku Klux Klan and we'd done the same thing? It wasn't a political view. It was a rule that still exists at the university. The rule is still in the books that says no one who belongs... And incidentally, when the issue was at its height about the membership in the American Communist Party, a little incident happened more or less unnoticed by the students that sort of bore out the fact that the American Communist Party does not allow its members to have freedom of thought. Dorothy Healy, an official of the Communist Party, officially known as such, was thrown out of the American Communist Party because she criticized the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. Now, if we're going to defend academic freedom...
But I don't see how that fact ties in.
Well, I think it indicates that those who passed the rule in the first place knew what they were talking about when they said that membership in that party prevents you from having your own thoughts, that you have to subscribe to the party dogma.
I don't have many more questions to go on that issue. I guess we could discuss that all day. So I think we'll go on. And I'd like to say that Chancellor Hines, in an interview, pointed out that Berkeley's reputation is the worst in the state of California and the best with people who know universities, namely other educators. That's a quote. Shouldn't the Board of Regents take the role of defending the university against attacks on its reputation instead of leading them?
Well, I wish you knew how many times the Board of Regents have played down things or discussed things on the basis of personnel being involved in executive session, trying not to add to the public feeling about Berkeley or any of the other campuses, because this has been their feeling and they have tried. But I have to say that many times, what cooperation have we had? What do you say to the people of California who have supported this university more handsomely than most states or all states have supported theirs, who have built it into a great institution, who've had great pride in it? But what do you say to them when you burn down Wheeler Hall? What do you say to them when you see the disturbances that have gone on? Chancellor Hines himself had to have his own home protected by the National Guard because a mob was attacking it and throwing rocks through the windows of his home on the campus. Now, let me just say this. When you say that the professional rating of the University of California, here too, let's be honest and frank. Great as the history of that institution has been, those who have extolled its academic rating in the last several years, other academicians, have confined their rating to its postgraduate work, to its graduate school. There has been no such praise for it at the undergraduate level for quite a number of years. And I think this is significant. I think the dropout rate in the University of California is significant. Here you have select students that have to be in the top 12.5% of their class to get in. So they're bright. They certainly are, they must be students devoted to learning. And yet the dropout rate in the University of California is higher than in almost any other institution you can name.
Could that be increasing the tuition, for instance?
No, this was...
The rising fees over the past years, the monetary reasons.
Then why wouldn't it apply to a Stanford where the tuition is up above $2,000 or a USC, where the students themselves just voted to raise their tuition this year $200?
Because those students, when they entered the institution, knew they were paying $2,000, and that the people that are going to the University of California in many cases were accepted at an institution comparable to Stanford or an institution that charges a high tuition fee and came to the University of California solely because they could not afford to go anywhere
else. Well, now some do, but on the other hand, that's not completely true because we found that the economic level of the families represented in the University of California is virtually on a level with the economic level of the families in these other schools. Now, it is true there are many students who are qualified and who choose the university for that reason, for economic reasons. But on the other hand, there are students at the University of California for whom it was a second or third choice who enrolled and because of the crowded numbers in some of these other schools, let's say, couldn't get into Stanford, and Berkeley was their second choice. Now, here is a student. What justice, again, we get back to the tuition thing, is if there's no economic consideration at all in the admission of students to the University of California. So we've talked so far today of the student who has economic difficulty in affording even that limited tuition or going to college at all. But what about the student who was perfectly willing to pay several thousand dollars tuition at another school and then simply because of the throw of the dice, he didn't get in there, and he wound up going to one with no tuition at all.
But his tax dollars are supposed to be supporting...
Oh, but his tax dollars are supporting that school anyway, even at the same time that he was willing to pay the several thousand dollars to go to another school. In other words, someplace along the line, we have to recognize that some public institutions were created with the idea of providing for those who couldn't make provision for their education someplace else. But ours is not so. We don't ask someone and say, are your economics such that you have to select the University of California? Therefore, the person whose family can be worth millions chooses the University of California, not for economic reasons, but because he prefers to go to that school. I know many students I know some students that offhand come to mind because of people around the state that I've met, and their families are of considerable means, and for affection or tradition or whatever, they've chosen to go at the University of California. Now, you might ask yourself, wouldn't there perhaps be something fair in either giving first call to those who needed the university or saying to the other one, if you were willing to go to Stanford and you couldn't get in there, you ought to be willing to pay the same tuition at the University of California that you were willing to pay to Stanford? I know that wouldn't work, but it's just to prompt some thinking on the subject.
Oh, one more question on that. Let me select the one while I ask that. Okay, President Hatch then, I believe it was, and I'm not really sure if it was him in charge, it might have been Chancellor Hines, but whatever, said with the budget cuts of recent years, that the university can no longer fulfill its traditional educational role in society. And if I'm not mistaken, then you replied publicly that education and the university are going to have to find a new role. And I wanted to ask you what you saw as the role of the university in society.
I don't believe I ever said anything about finding a new role. I certainly took them on about the idea of, first of all, just as you used here, the term budget cuts of the last few years. There have been no budget cuts. We have cut the amount, the request the university's made. But then you can go back as far as you want to go in the history of California, and I guess you'll find that the university never did get any year as much as it asked for, nor does the highway patrol, nor mental health, nor public services, or any of the state agencies. Government, traditionally, the various departments ask for what they'd like to have, and then the fellow that's sitting up here and has to divide up the money that's come in from the people establishes priorities and tries to give it out. Now, the truth is, education has been the number one priority in California. And we've, each year, the university has gotten an increase in its budget. And the increases over 4 years have been, for the university, their budgets have, they're now getting 42% more than they were getting then, and they've only had a 22% increase in enrollment in that same period. Now, for next year, because we're in a crisis, everybody in California is, well, the nation is for that matter. We're in an economic slump, a recession. Our revenues are down, and a thing called welfare, which we can't control because that is mandated on us, so we don't establish the priority there, is taking such an increased percentage of the money. Yes, we've asked the university to swallow, you might say, its increase in enrollment for the coming year and exist on the same budget that it had for the present year.
On that subject, I'd just like you to quickly comment then on the fact that in this coming year, the budget that you have returned calls for cutting the faculty by 100 faculty members at the time when they requested 281 more, so there's a net loss of 381. At the same time, the enrollment is going to increase 4,000 students. And I've been assured that this did not even happen during the Depression, that the university wasn't subject to such a drastic drawback. And as I guess you can't call them cuts, as you mentioned, because you have increased the budget.
Yeah.
But only 9.4% of the 42% that you have mentioned of increase has gone toward new and expanding programs. The rest has been absorbed by increasing costs, so that it's sort of a lost increase.
Yeah. Did you know, though, that the first time I ever proposed tuition for the university, that I proposed that a sizable portion of that tuition that the student ought to be able to see reflected in his educational opportunities, his increased cost, and that a sizable portion of that be assessed to provide new courses, new educational programs, and it was the administration of the university that refused because then that would make it tuition instead of a fee.
But now we do have tuition, and we still have new programs.
And they won't call it tuition, or they won't admit this. And what I've said is exactly what you're talking about. If a student is going to pay tuition and pay for part of his education, then the money he's paying shouldn't go for Mickey Mouse gimmicks or something to somehow avoid it being meeting the test of tuition. The student ought to be able to see it reflected in improved education, in improved quality or improved quantity if it means new courses or something. And once and for all, I would like to see the university get off this kick about this and say, here is this money, and it should be used for educational opportunities for the people that are going to school. Now, we've ignored, you talk about student aid or anything, the problems of students coming to school, you've ignored the fact that under my administration, when I came here, there was only $3 million a year in the state scholarship fund. It's now $20 million a year. Now, that's a rather sizable increase. I don't place a low priority in education. I happen to say at the present time and for the coming year, yes, I admit we are asking cutbacks. We're asking our own in-state employees to take no salary increase this year. We're postponing things we would like to do and can't do. We're like anyone else in this time of recession, a family that says, well, we're going to have to make the old car go another year because Dad isn't making as much money as he made last year, or he's been laid off. Now, the people of California are undergoing unemployment, the threat of unemployment, thousands of trained and skilled persons through no fault of their own have no jobs. Other people are not having the same income they had. Business profits are down, and I'm not talking about the great corporations, although theirs are down too. I'm talking about the little guy, the little businessman. I just don't feel that in this temporary time of economic stress, the government should be the only segment of society that knows no recession, that we should just go and clobber the people over the head and take more money away from them and increase taxes. Because it isn't that we're sitting here with money we refuse to spend. We don't have the money. And we've asked education, as well as every other state department, to join the people of California in tightening our belts through a time of recession.
I know we're running long on time, but in the future then, where is the money going to come as the needs of the university increase? We're in a time of recession now, but next year, hopefully we won't be, but is there going to be money for the university then next year, the year in the future?
Well, we feel that this economic recession is a temporary thing. We think the signs, I think, and even your own economists will, but the signs are there that we are coming out of it. Now, as employment picks up, our income tax increases, the take from our income tax, our sales tax increases as business gets better. We knew we were in trouble in the Christmas rush last year because all we have to do is look at the Christmas buying to know that our sales tax revenue is either going to be normal or above normal or below normal, and there was no Christmas rush. We knew we were hurt. And now, on the other hand, along came this Easter, and there were signs of improvement. So we think we are coming out of it, and we will be able to. But along the line with some of the things that you mentioned earlier, the lack of construction on the campus, maybe someplace along the line the Lord was a little good to us in the failure of some of the bond issues to pass. Suppose we had gotten the bond issue and gone ahead. Now, don't mistake me. There is needed building. Certainly in our medical facilities, we need an expansion of our medical schools. But suppose we had gone ahead on the original master plan of the university, which now the university itself has just acknowledged is out of date, that we had thought that the university was going to increase in such size that in a few years there'd be 250,000 students. And we've just found out that California is no longer accelerating its growth at that rate. Not only is the birth rate down, the in-migration is down, and the figure is not 250,000 now that it's going to increase to, it's 130,000. Well, what if we had planned great, grand, eloquent buildings? I remember a couple of years ago, we as regents were discussing a whole big thousands of acres site for a whole new campus. Now, suddenly, we've discovered our growth isn't going to be that great. We're not going to need it. In a way, we're kind of lucky. We might have been stuck with some buildings we didn't need, just as this state at the moment is stuck with a couple of correctional institutions that were started under the previous administration. They've been completed. They stand there empty because our reform and rehabilitation programs in the last 4 years have been so successful, we don't have the prisoners to put in them. Now, I'm happy about that. I'm sorry we got the buildings built. And we're trying to find a good use for them, someplace they can be used. But I think all of us are delighted that we can say in California, our prison population is down to less than it was in 1962. Because our rehabilitation and parole efforts have been more successful in other states than they've ever been here before.
Okay, thank you very much, Governor.
You bet. I wish we had more time. We'll do it again.
All right, I'll take you up on that.
All right.